Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There are stories and mythology that this country has woven around Black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like wary of the police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I'm Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diamond.
This is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
How are you, Rob?
I'm feeling really excited.
Are you? Why is that?
Because we have an amazing guest today.
We have the best guest.
Who I have only ever met once before on our booth at Frieze Art Fair many years ago. I think it was like the second year I was working at Carl Friedman Gallery. Mm-hmm. And this guest came on and said hello. And our guest was dressed as Claire. At that event, mm-hmm. I think because it was a big, glamorous opening, VIP preview. Yeah. And I know that our guest likes to dress as Claire on special events.
I don't dress as Claire anymore at Vries, though, because
oh, really?
I get pestered to death. I get pecked to death. And I'd never get anywhere without having to do a selfie every 5 feet. So I don't do it anymore.
Good to know. Yeah. our guest is also a CBE and an RA. And Russell loves that because he loves having CBEs on the show.
It looks good in the playlist if you ever name it a CBE or MBE next to it. I feel like we've achieved something.
Really ridiculous. Yeah. But we would like to welcome the artist. Grayson Perry.
Hello.
Hello.
How you doing?
I'm great. Yeah. I'm on an up. My life is charmed.
Is it?
Yes, totally.
Has something changed recently?
No. You know, I live in a glamorous world and I'm at a point in my career where I can ask for whatever I want. Pretty much I can get it and I make a decent living and I do lots of fun things and travel and, you know, I have a really charmed life.
What's an example of something that you want that you've got recently?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, if I sort of say to Channel 4, I quite fancy making a TV series in America about the political divides, then they go, okay.
And you've literally just done that.
I've just come back from the States having made a three-part series about the social and political divides in America. And it's been great fun because I like America. I like travelling there.
Yeah.
And they were interesting, open. Well, of course, you know, our researchers always get the best correspondence to talk.
Do you have researchers that you use for all your projects? Are they the same people that you trust? Or
We have a kind of, you know, a kind of shifting staff in the thing, but I think we have people, we often get people in who might be, you know, the right people for that subject,
right?
You know, or demographic sometimes. It's useful. I always like to be on a shoot where there's at least half women. I always feel weird tromping into people's houses when it's all men.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Totally.
So the American show you've just been recording, you did an earlier show about the British political divide and Brexit.
I did.
Which then led to the Serpentine exhibition, is that correct?
That is correct, yeah.
So I saw that documentary. So is that partly why you were looking at a kind of larger global, because it's all happening all over the world, isn't it? This kind of political
divide
and change.
I think the basic kind of divide is nationalism versus globalization. You know, I think that most of the things can be sort of summed up. People have done well out of globalization, people who haven't, and a kind of retreat into identity.
And do you do this through like an art route, like people looking at art and how that political
No, it's just, I mean, this last one is the most straight documentary I've done in that I go round and just talk to a bunch of people and find out stuff,
mm-hmm.
You know. There's no art in this one. Though I will make art on it. I am actually already working on art that has spun out of my experience
really?
In America. Yeah, and I'll be going to Frieze New York next year, so I'll be taking those to Frieze New York so I can maybe tell what I found out about America.
And you're using photographs then from this trip and you're making them?
No, just ideas more. And you know, and art I might have seen on the way and mm-hmm. kind of aesthetic influences. You know, I pick and choose from everywhere. You know, I'm not I would say contemporary art is pretty low down on the list of things that influences my work.
Really?
Yeah.
Other people's contemporary art.
Yeah. There's not many contemporary artists. I think, oh, I like that. That's. I mean, it happens.
Who do you like?
What, out of contemporary artists?
Yes.
I like Mark Bradford very much at the moment. Yes. I think he's quite cool. And I like, what's his name? Joshua, is it something? Joshua, I can't remember what his name is. He does interiors, though. He's a West Coast American artist. I think he's very good.
Okay, not Jonas Wood.
Jonas Wood,
yes,
that's what I mean.
Yes.
I like his work.
Yeah, his interiors of houses and stuff, but it's kind of...
his
it
wife
looks like
is
it's
the potter.
That's right.
Yes, exactly. Yeah,
Shio
yeah.
Kasaka.
Shio Kasaka. Right. Yeah,
oh, okay, yeah, I like his paintings.
I've got a pot by her. Do you like her?
I don't know. I'm not that familiar with her work. I'm right. familiar with his paintings.
Yeah.
Which but I then like if you're her work is often shown in his paintings.
Yes, true. Yeah.
And actually, there's an interesting link to you because I guess a lot of his work is autobiographical as well. And you have a kind of sense of him working out his own psychology through his art.
Yeah, I did that. I went through a phase of that.
Yeah,
I think I would say now my work is more about a wider sort of social issues. All work is autobiographical to a certain extent.
Yeah.
But now I would say my work is like, I've been through my introspective therapy phase, you know.
Mm-hmm. And I think, interestingly, that was when I connected most to your work in the early days when you were, you know, working out your mind, I guess, and like your experiences. Like, I was really into collages you made.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
Probably about 15 years ago or so that Victoria Miro had. And I went to see them all. And they were like really confused where I wanted to see them and not the pots at the time. I think everyone wanted to see the pots, but I was really into these collages of like Claire and motorcycles and
Alan Measles.
Yeah, I mean, they were things that I did from when I was a student. You know, I still keep a sketchbook, quite an elaborate sketchbook in those days. So that was my main means of expression. And that was my style. So I would have a whole huge stack of magazines and old encyclopedias and I would chop them up and make stuff. Yeah, I enjoyed that. And in many ways, that is, I've been kind of trying to replicate that energy and technique in other media. I mean, like, it took me a long time to be able to do it with pottery.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You know, to get up with a piece of paper, you just put a bit of glue on the back and stick it down on a pot, you know, to get that ceramic version of that is actually quite fiddly and long-winded.
But that is actually a photograph in there, or is that some
the
other
pots, yeah.
phrasing?
No, you have to send a photograph off to a firm in Stoke-on-Trent. They make it into a transfer, which you put on top of the glaze and then fire it on. So it's a long-winded process. It's much quicker than it used to be and much, much cheaper than
really?
It used to be. Digital technology has been my greatest friend in the last 10 years or so with the tapestries and with the pots. And also to start and set drawing. I just love drawing on the computer rather than paper because you can be more ambitious and you can correct it and you can do things that would take you a week in an hour.
Right.
I was always quite interested in this idea that when I first discovered about your pots, say, and I would hear you talk about them, you would often emphasise the fact that they weren't thrown, they were done as coil pots.
Yeah.
But when you actually look at them, they're often way more technically advanced than a thrown one would be anyway. Because yes, the thrown one, especially at a larger scale, it takes a lot of energy to have the skill to do that.
Yeah.
But yours are incredibly skilled. And I think the thing I love about them is this idea of the collaged elements and the story and the narrative and it's not even that surprise thing, because you often hear people go like, the thing about him is you see it and you think it's just a domestic pot, and then you get there and you see all these disturbing topics and stuff.
Yeah.
But it's not even so much that shock factor, you know, that you're not expecting to see what you're going to see on it. It's more the actual like technical
because I think people know what my work's like is like.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah, they know what to expect when they come to my exhibition.
Yeah.
And so it's about sort of technical and the exquisite and things like that and that kind of mastery of layering and subtle kind of interaction of images. I mean, I did do a piece recently that had that effect of shock, which was the carpet I made for my recent show, which is it's a real carpet made in Spain by a hand carpet maker, but it's got a homeless person on it. And it's called Don't Look Down. And it's a very seductive object. You know, it's nice colours. It's a really nice carpet. And you think, ooh, I like that carpet. And then you go, ooh, you know. And that idea of walking on something that has a homeless person on it. And it's all about those sort of, that kind of glass floor below the super rich. Or not the super rich. I'd say the reasonably okay off.
Mm-hmm.
So for your new show in Mayfair, was the location, I know the idea came out of this idea that someone had spoken to you at the Royal Academy and said, oh, the yellow colour you've painted on the wall is an interior decoration colour almost. And then that...
It was more about the way I'd arranged the room, because I arranged the room in a... It was, the yellow was great. That really worked. but also I'd arranged the room, I'd sort of done it kind of like frame to frame all the way around, but in a spectrum. So I had like orange and green and black and white and mm-hmm. red and blue all going around the room. And it was, and then I grouped them. They also had loads of political jokes in there as well. But it was quite of a piece, I suppose, you know. And I think there's still a snobbery between the kind of high-minded political intellectual sort of part of making art and the decorative, sensuous, covetable side of art. And I try to sit in the middle on that. You know, I try to use politicalized social ideas, and I'm also trying to make objects that people really want.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And they do.
Yeah, of course they do. And that's great. And I don't know, I think maybe some people find that like I've sold out, or they find it disturbing, or that I'm a hypocrite. And I go, yeah, 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 three, tick, 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 you know, take it on the chin, mate. Complicated idea. Oh, grow up.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, I think the art world is sort of often mired in this sort of idea that seriousness is only the sort of right on, intellectually obscure, difficult idea. You know, you come into it, you come out of an exhibition feeling like you've done your homework.
Mm.
You know, but people go to galleries on their day off.
Mm-hmm. Well, I do.
Exactly. It's a leisure activity, folks.
Do you feel like you get a hard time for your art, for the messages you're putting out there? Do you feel like you've...
Maybe from some art world insiders who feel obliged to kind of like rail against my kind of pandering to popularity and accessibility. You know, but, and then they moan, oh, he's too famous now. You know, his celebrity is getting in the way of his work. And it's like, didn't stop Picasso.
Yeah, yeah,
you know,
yeah.
It doesn't stop Gilbert and George. Doesn't stop all the other famous artists in the world. So why is it me that they're picking on?
And actually, I feel like whenever you've done really accessible things like making TV series, they're often very linked to your making anyway. Like, even though the American one hasn't necessarily had work made yet, but it's going to respond to, the new work's going to respond to that experience.
Yeah.
It's like, you have always managed to connect it with your practice.
Yeah, and it, you know, it is a separate thing. I silo my creativity. So I have TV is definitely TV. It is no way video art. You know, my stage performances are a night out, having a bit of a laugh, you know, sort of almost stand-up.
Yeah.
My artwork is my artwork. You know, they're not performance art and video art. You know,
you're able to make work while you're also doing those other projects.
Yeah,
yeah, and everything, they're everything all serious.
Everything links, though. Like,
they're all serious.
They all feed
serious
into each other. Yeah,
comedy is deadly serious. You know, it's you know, people who think that comedy is a lighter thing. You know, the art critic of the Telegraph once sent the theatre critic to review the summer show because he said, oh, it's comedy. And I say, fuck you, yeah, it's fucking comedy.
Yeah.
And all the better for it, because, you know, po-faced, earnest sort of think pieces are just the people, yawn-a-rama, you know. You know, it's a profound thing. A profound thing.
Yeah.
So when you first started making work and you would look at the art world, did you always feel a kind of need to try and break down the elitism? Was it something that really bothered you?
It's lovely to have something to kick against. You know, it's so inspiring, and there's nothing like a little bit of an irritability and mischief to sort of like get you off your hind legs in the morning, you know, and really get you going. And yeah, I'm happy to, I'm always on the lookout for something that kind of is a bit barbed, is a bit mischievous, and maybe makes people uncomfortable, because, you know, the art world thrives on that and always has done. It's just that now it tends to be coming from a different angle. Because, you know, the 20th century was this great formal experimentation, and people were going, are you Rydell? How could that be art? You know, get over it. No, we've done it now. We've done all that. But now I think as art is focusing on the socio-political world, you know, and it's very much about those sort of issues, that's where the edge is. The edge is also around the back of those issues when you're dealing with socio-political issues that they perhaps don't agree with, or they don't want to think the art world is a part of, or something like that. And I mean, you want to go, mate, you know, get with it, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because there's this sort of assumption that we're all on the same page sometimes. You know, we're all right on students still.
Yes. I want to now imagine you making your pots, and I want to know, especially the ceramics, the process you go through and you used to go through and how that's changed. You're saying about how using computers now has sped things up, but how you would go to work, basically. How long are you...
If I'm starting on a piece,
yeah.
I mean, it's still the same process exactly. I've refined it over the years, but the actual process is pretty much the same. You know, I will I'll have an idea for a part, and you, quite often I'll go through all my books on ceramics or even go to a museum and look for something that will be the kind of, give me an idea about the shape.
Would that be like the V&A, like the ceramics?
Yeah, I'll go to the V&A ceramics department or the British Museum or somewhere and look at vases and get a kind of feel for maybe some overall textural or colour balance or something like that, that kind of feel of it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'll go home and I'll do a very rudimentary little sketch of what I want to do with just a few notes saying, you know, this part is going to be about the Tories or thin women with art or whatever.
Mm.
And then I think when I've got an idea of like the kind of idea of the part, I'll think about that the shape has to sort of somehow, because there's a language there, which is very unconscious, which is certain shapes are more utilitarian. Certain shapes are more about kind of drawing room elegance. Certain shapes are more primal. Certain shapes are associated with different cultures, and
so what suits the message or
so there's a vague thing, and then I sort of work out how big is it going to be. I do a cardboard template of half of a silhouette so I've got something to work against, and then I roll out the base, start coiling it, and you do about, I'd say no more than about 6 to 8 inches at a time probably. And you just let it dry for a day, and then you add the next layer and add the next layer and add the next layer. And then when you've got the whole shape, you carve that down, you refine it so it's really nice and smooth, and then you start applying all the decoration, which might be layers of slip, stencil it, stamp it, inlay it, carve it, put on little knobbly bits that I've got, all those little moulds that I can put on.
Yeah.
And then you fire that, and then you glaze it and paint it, and then finally you put the transfers on. And the last thing you always do is put the luster on, the gold of a silver or mother of pearl or something like that.
And do you go into a trance-like state when you're making art?
Do you think you can call Radio 4 or like my playlist a kind of trance-like state? I don't know, no. I mean, yeah, there's lots of kind of what I call dibbing, you know, which is just getting on with it, which is one of the joys, you know, as opposed to, say, writing a book, which where you can't really coast.
Yeah.
But, you know, when you're making art, it's loads of, sometimes whole days where I'm just going dib, 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 doing the same thing all day.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that. That's like a joy.
You don't ever get frustrated in yourself that you've decided to make this and you've given yourself a really hard task.
Every single piece I do that. Every single piece you do that. Because that golden fuzzy glow of the imagined artwork out there, you know, that's great. That's when you have that kind of, the real nub of it. But then as soon as you start to kind of bring that idea into focus and have to make, you realize there's 1,000 decisions you have to make and they're going to be onerous and you're going to agonize over things and things are going to be long and boring to do, even though you've had the thought in a moment. And the final thing when you open the kiln for the fine time is usually a disappointment.
Is it?
Yeah, compared to the golden fuzzy cloud.
The fantasy in the reality,
And then how often do you destroy them? Like,
never!
Never.
You know how much they're worth?
No, because that's not true. Because I heard that in the early days you would make four, and like one in four you would have to destroy because you didn't like it.
Yeah, and
these days, are you better at doing it, do you think?
I was very hard on my own work, and now I spot mistakes coming down the road.
I'm
so experienced now that I know when a pot is going wrong from early on, so I knock it back on course.
So you fix it before you... That's interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. What does Grayson eat and drink in the studio to supply himself with the energy needed?
Well, I just go to... I mean, I either bring in a sandwich that I've made myself in the morning, or I...
What would be in the sandwich?
Cheese and salad sandwich.
Lovely.
You know? Yeah, no, just something basic like that. Or, you know, sometimes I pop to Pret and get something a bit fancier.
Ooh, lovely.
Or I go to the caf, you know, and have egg and sausage and chips. You know? Yeah. Which I have to watch now because I am a little bit, especially after America, I'm a little bit Tubbsky.
Yeah, the proportions over there are a bit more than sausages, definitely. Yeah. Do you ever make work in the studio by yourself as Claire?
No!
No?
Too messy.
Oh, yeah, it would ruin.
And distracting.
Right.
You know, it'd be like kind of working with your girlfriend on your lap.
Yeah. When did you name... can we say it's an alter ego?
No. It's me in a dress.
But I agree, because I don't think it is an alter ego. And that, I always think that's a really kind of, that's a way for like other people to like get their head around it.
Yeah.
Because I feel like it's a whole. I feel like you are just a person and that's a part of your personality and that's who you are.
Yeah, some days I wear a raincoat and some days, you know, I don't, you know, and that's just like the dressing up. But obviously it's fetish. you know, it's a turn on. You know,
it is.
Yeah, but I mean, my latter years, you know, so that doesn't play quite such a big part. But, you know, early on, it was like tentpole city, you know.
Really?
Of course.
So you'd be at events as Claire and you'd have a...
No, I never used to go to events that often. And no, you wouldn't be at events. Well, maybe you would. Depends what the club was, I suppose.
Because you lived in a bedsit with Boy George.
No.
Oh, is that not true?
We're going to correct this now.
This comes up every time someone's read my fucking Wikipedia.
Oh, okay.
No, I never did. I knew him a little tiny bit before he became famous because we moved in the same circles.
Right.
And... yeah, but it's on. I think it's on my Wikipedia page, and then it always comes up, and I always have to deny it. Yeah, scrub it off.
How did you come up with the name Claire? Why was Claire?
Oh, that was my then girlfriend Jen. Because when I joined a transvestite club,
mm-hmm.
they insisted on anonymity because it was people didn't want to, other people didn't want them to know that they're dressing up and whatever. So they insisted on a femme-name, and you all had to have a femme-name. And so my girlfriend just looked at me and went, oh, you're Claire.
This club? Was this in London or Essex?
No, it was a national organisation called the Beaumont. I think it's still going, the Beaumont Society. And they had kind of meetings in, you know, all over the country in different areas, you know, and you'd go and you'd have a little sort of vetting meeting to make sure you were sort of...
genuine.
And then you would go to the meetings and they have like... you know, weekends in hotels and things like that.
What was that? I mean, what was that like for the first time of having an outlet?
Weird meeting other transvestites for the first time because suddenly you look at them and go, that's me. I'm the man in the funny man in the dress.
Uh-huh.
But they were jolly. The first two I met, he was brilliant. One of them was a farmer and they'd been sailing all day en femme.
Really?
On the Solent, yeah.
Have you made friends for life from these?
No, I don't know many transvestites now because I don't have the time or... yeah, the energy to do it anymore.
I've been quite interested in this idea that when you're growing up and you have like this feeling that you want to be a transvestite, say, and it's probably a very like private, personal thing, and you wouldn't necessarily discuss it with your family, or you know, this could just be a generalization here, but then for you to then become this kind of well-known artist, where part of the reason, in a way, that you've had such a lot of publicity and attention to your work. I mean, I've heard you speak about this idea that it almost helped you because getting attention in the art world can be a difficult thing.
It's
been a huge kind of help to you.
Yeah.
But it's quite interesting how private and personal it would have been, and almost like maybe feelings of shame and all this kind of stuff that you have with it.
Delicious shame.
Yeah.
What an aphrodisiac.
But then, exactly, yeah. But then how
is it
public it's become. Wow. How it's almost become like a super strength, like a public strength or something.
Yeah, it's kind of weird. I mean, but from my point of view, you know, fame has ruined being a transvestite because I'm no longer that weird pervert that you can kind of, you know, that feels humiliated walking down the street. Now I'm Grayson Perry, the artist.
Well, we were talking about the other night because it's like people talk to you like the common man will come up to you as Claire and just speak to you without any...
Yeah, I hope one of the good things I've done in my kind of cross-dressing is kind of normalize it, or at least make it approachable and not scary and weird, you know, and it's fine, you know, and it, so that's a good thing that's come out of it, I think.
Did you ever feel threatened when you first started doing it, like on the street or walking around?
I might feel threatened. Whether I was is another matter. You know, I had the odd dodgy moment, but we all have dodgy moments. Yeah. You know, the person most likely to get attacked in the world is a teenage boy, you know.
I had that experience.
Yeah, horrible, I think, you know, statistically. I mean, now I wonder about, you know, I was at a party the other night and I couldn't be bothered to get a cab and I walked home half an hour in a frock and it was fine. As long as I got flatties on.
You always keep them in your purse.
No. So I'm of an age where flatties are becoming increasingly attractive.
Do you know what I love? Is that every year, and it's still ongoing, is it an annual thing where you have the students at St. Martin's, yeah, Fashion College, around the road,
around the
corner,
yeah,
design a frock for Claire every year?
No, 20 frocks.
What?
Yeah.
But do you
need more than one.
So every student gets to design a frock for you every year. That's part of like the course now.
Yeah, second year fashion print. I've done it for 15 years.
And you fund that. That's something you...
I buy the frocks, yeah. I
off pay them.
Off right. them, yeah. I give them, I think at the moment it's like 550 quid I give to them if I choose their frock, which usually is about, half to two thirds, I'd say.
Wow.
They've got to put in the effort. It's a real exchange. It's not like some, you know, exercise.
Yeah.
If the customer doesn't like it, then it's not going
to
happen.
And do you go in every year to get measured up with them and stuff? Do you do all that?
I go in once a week for like 6 weeks. So I go in for a day and I look at their designs and I sort of push them in the direction I think that will work for me. And you know, I've done it a long time now. So
how many years has it been going on?
15.
And have any of them designers gone on to be like huge superstar designers?
Curiously, the other day I was walking down Bond Street, and I never normally am drawn to stuff in Bond Street, but I saw this coat and I thought, that coat looks like it's bloody made for me, I thought. You know, and it was like this puffer jacket with big daisies on it and it had Diamante buttons. And I bought it. And then I worked out it was designed by Richard Quinn, who was somebody that I sort of worked with here as a student.
Wow.
And I think he even won the prize because I give prizes.
For the best one.
Yeah, and he was very, you know, talented, obviously talented, and very ambitious is what I got. He had a lot of energy.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, he's now a recognised working designer. It's great.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
I feel like the evolution of Claire, if you look at like the history of the way you were dressing as Claire before and then you look now, the outfits seem to be getting more and more kind of glamorous by the week. I mean, more and more kind of extreme somehow.
Yeah.
Like, is that something that's come through that collaboration?
Yeah, totally. I mean, you know, I tend to design the clothes for myself now. Like every year I work with my dressmaker and I make two or three outfits for myself. On the whole, they tend to be on the wearable end of a spectrum because the students will supply the unwearable thing.
Wow.
You know, like if I want an outfit that for a big red carpet, then the students will do it for me.
Right.
If I want something to look relatively, you know, innocuous walking down the street, I have to design it for myself.
And who would be like your style kind of icons that you would look to for Claire? Like, are there
depends. I've got a
or,
range, you know. Like, I love some designers, say, like, someone like Anish Arora, I think his name is, you know, the Indian designer. I think he's really great. And there's quite a few designers. The present incumbent in Gucci, I think, he's great. You know, I like those. But, you know, my budget doesn't run to that. But and they probably wouldn't fit me anyway. But style-wise, you know, it could be anything from sort of historical dress. But, you know, things like, I've always had a thing for the kind of big, bouffant, well-groomed woman, you know,
right.
Like someone like Rain Spencer or Margaret Thatcher, you know, those kind of women have always been, because that's what I grew up with. That was they were the 1960s women that I grew up around. And that's when your sexuality is formed. You know, that's why, you know, everybody's a fetishist. You know, it's just that some fetishists are seen as normal. You know, if you like big tits or muscly men or tall people, then, you know, that's a fetish.
Yes.
Yeah. And where do you store the dresses?
Good point. Yeah, I
You have an archive.
Yeah, I do.
Do you?
I've still got most of. Yeah, I think I've got them all pretty much still.
So you've never given thrown any away.
No, I think that would be unfair. Plus, you know, I never know, they might come in.
But you only wear them once, right?
No.
Oh, right.
Some I've worn a lot. You know, I, every year, when I'm doing the briefing, I sort of say to them, you know. I want you to go mad, but remember that I show them the pictures of the dresses I've worn the most. And I said, the thing is, they're comfy. I can wear them.
Yeah.
I can wear them when it gets over 20 degrees centigrade.
Yeah.
And, you know, they haven't fell apart. You know,
these
three simple things. But you would be surprised that every year, like last year, I don't think there was hardly an outfit that I could have worn on a summer's day. You know, they were all too hot.
So we're waiting for the V&A.
I was going to say, this is like a V&A exhibition. It's like when Kylie did her one. I'm sure Lady Gaga will do one Monday. But yeah,
I've got a couple of hundred dresses.
Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah.
Are they all hanging up or are they?
Yeah, they're all.
No,
they're all hanging up in bags mainly. Yeah. So I look after them and I keep them in the dark. That's quite important too.
Right.
Because they fade. Things fade, you know, or just look a bit secondhand if you leave them in the sun all the time.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, this is Russell Tovey and Robert Diamond from Talk Arts, the arts podcast. And we're here today with Budweiser beer. And we're going to be talking about something very, very important to both of us, aren't we, Rob?
That's right. Budweiser, the king of beers, has joined forces with legendary artist Sir Peter Blake, the godfather of British pop art and someone that both of us have adored since we were kids.
I've loved pop art since I was a kid, and Sir Peter Blake has been a constant for me, alongside other pop art artists, the Americans like Andy Warhol, Roy Lichtenstein, Keith Haring. And I got into pop art, Rob, because I loved cartoons growing up. I mean, I still love animation. But suddenly I discovered that so many artists were referencing comic strips and cartoons in their artworks, and I could go and see them in museums, and I suddenly didn't need to grow up. And Sir Peter Blake was one of these artists that meant so much to me. And I think people, if they don't know the name Sir Peter Blake, you would certainly know his work. The album cover for The Beatles, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club, Oasis's Stop the Clocks. These are iconic art historical moments that this artist has actually been at the forefront of.
And you've met him, haven't you?
I've met him, yeah, at the South Bank Show Awards years ago. I was there for the History Boys, and he was there, and I got incredibly excited and met him. But you've not met him before, have you, Rob?
I have. I've actually even been to his house and hung out with him and his wife, and I got to make an amazing print with him, which was a huge privilege, actually. It was a real career moment for me. So Budweiser and Sir Peter Blake have come together to unite, and they have created an exclusive limited edition beer can, which doubles as a collectible piece of pop art.
And it was on display at London's Truerman Brewery on the 23rd and 24th of March this year, if you were lucky enough to get there. And also, were you one of the lucky few that were able to get one of the signed beer cans by Sir Peter Blake himself? And there was something very special there, wasn't there, Rob? What was that?
They've actually made the first ever fridge frame, which kind of is reminiscent of what we would be, you know, accustomed with in terms of a museum exhibit. Yeah. But this fridge frame is designed to display the limited edition can of beer as a work of art, but also keeps the beer cool.
Okay, I need a fridge full of fridge frames because this sounds incredible. So Peter Blake's work adorns the cans with all of his eye-catching simplicity. It features the Budweiser's iconic red bow tie logo, but it's encompassed by the artist's signature and his use of block colours and icons. They unveiled this artistic can in all of its glory in one of these fridge frames, as Rob said, which is very exciting. The limited edition cans are available to purchase as a four-pack for a limited time only in selected Tesco stores nationwide.
Budweiser and Sir Peter Blake, thank you for bringing us this cultural moment. I love it when art reaches new audiences, and I really feel like this is going to go into everyone's homes, and it's really joyous. So head over to Tesco, pick up a four-pack. Thank you, Budweiser.
But also, if you want to get this collectible piece of art at home, Budweiser also giving people the chance to own their very own exclusive fridge frame. Beer and art lovers can register their interest by visiting www.budweiser.co.uk/Sir Peter Blake collab. That's budweiser.co.uk/Sir Peter Blake collab. Budweiser and Talk Art with Sir Peter Blake.
And I know that you designed, I listened to your podcast with Jay Rayner, the food critic.
Yes.
And you went, for people listening to this podcast, you can also check that one out. It's called Out to Lunch with Jay Rayner. But in that one, you turned up to the lunch wearing like a PVC outfit that you created. I loved the sound of that outfit, though.
That was one of
was
my
it
most
squeaking all the way through?
Genius.
Was it? No, I don't know.
But apparently it was perfect because if you spill food on it, you can just wipe it straight off. Yeah. But it was like a kind of jumpsuit almost that you'd wear skiing or something as a kid.
Yeah, it was sort of based on, I suppose, what, you know, I see little kids in their little puffer jackets, you know, that were really colourful, and I thought, you can't get an adult version of that. So I actually designed my own kind of kiddie fabric, very colourful, with dolls and flowers and teddy bears on it and stuff. And mm-hmm. I blew it up to my scale. Mm-hmm. And then I had it printed, and then I had it covered in PVC. Mm-hmm. And then then I designed an outfit that's like a giant puffer jacket with matching sort of knickerbocker dungarees. Mm-hmm. And boots, patent leather boots as well. All of, and it's even got mittens and a hood as well, if I want, with fur around. So I look like
you didn't wear that to lunch. So you didn't wear the mittens while you was eating.
No. But that's, you know, it's a look. It's one of my fave looks, you know, because it's sort of fun. But it needs to be a relatively cool day to wear that one.
Yeah.
And for your new show, you've actually done a series of bags.
Yes.
Is it with Osprey?
Yes.
And those have clasps that are like the penis of Alan Measles, no?
Yeah, yeah.
I love that kind of subvert.
Because I like those little brass latches you get on posh handbags. And so I thought, it's Alan Measles. And then in order to close it, you have to sort of push his penis through and twist his balls, yeah.
So thinking of that product, you've made a lot of like memorabilia and artist
edition
and
multiples. And I think you're one of the artists that does that quite successfully. I remember when you did your British Museum show, which I think is probably one of the greatest things you did. I mean, I think it was so intelligent as well.
Right? Huh? This is the Alan Measles.
As opposed to my other shows, you mean?
No. I don't mean that. I'm just saying I think it's a really important show, that one. Really liked it. I had a long chat with Louisa Buck once about it. And I think the way you put your work within that context of history, and it was actually really, really well done. I think it's a difficult thing to pull off, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, I was competing with the entirety of world civilization.
Exactly.
That was a big ask.
But I think that proved your kind of intellectual, you know, prowess or whatever.
No, it's one of my proudest achievements.
Yeah, exactly. But one of the things I loved is the merchandise that came with that. Like, do you enjoy that side?
Yeah.
Because like my cousins, for example, Jenny and my goddaughter, Keris, they buy a lot of your products. And she has one of your
piggy banks,
exactly. Oh, yeah. And then a scarf, I think, and a tea towel and all these different things. And they seem to bring such joy to such a wider audience.
I treat them on the whole like artworks in themselves, you know, especially the scarves and things like that. I work with a guy called Kit Grover who specializes in the merchandise for art galleries, and he's brilliant. So he'll always interpret, I don't know if it's him or me that came up with the idea of a yoga mat for this show, you know.
Yeah.
And it was like instantly it was like perfect, you know. Yeah. Yoga mat, you know, it says so much about the kind of people I'm talking about, you know, those sort of breezy people signaling their virtue.
Right.
I like yoga.
I'm sure you do it for all the right reasons, whatever they are.
I just want to say that Alan Measles was your teddy bear. That's what we're referencing growing
up. Yes, very important, Alan Measles. He's my kind of, now that people know who he is, I can use him as a shorthand all the time for kind of masculinity or God. You know, so he's like a kind of character that I've done dozens of times in my work.
And he's still living in your bedroom now?
Yeah, on his golden throne.
But the original Alan Measles doesn't look like... Because the one that you've created within your work and your drawings is so kind of fantastical, multicoloured, kind of exaggerated form. But I've seen the actual picture of the real Alan Measles.
Yeah, he's a real old-fashioned
kind of World War II almost, like teddy bear. It reminds me of a grandma.
Like evacuees or something.
I actually love him, I like the character within the work, but he's become more like some sort of avatar or some kind of...
Yeah, like, exactly that. And that's how I've used him. You know, I sort of take him on a tour, depending on what culture I'm sort of ripping off this week. You know, I'll do a kind of version. So, you know, we've had Islamic Alan and Chinese Alan and kind of African Alan. You know, we had different versions of Alan over the years.
And I found the whole story of when you were a child, like growing up, and you might have had like trauma within your family home, you know, with your stepfather and so on. But this idea that your fantasy world that started to be created and your imagination and I guess your creative artist mind as it grew as a young child was a kind of associated with that bear and you kind of creating narratives for that bear.
Yeah, and that's still what goes on now. You know, yeah. And I think we lay down the kind of basic pathways of our imagination and our creativity in childhood, and then they become the kind of motorways, if you like, of your imagination, and then you grow off of little branches, all, you know. And that's how, you know, it's formed, you know. And so one major branch was my sexuality, another major branch was Alan Measles and my fantasy world, you know. And then, you know, other things have come along as I've got more... older and more educated, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. And I like that idea that creativity and imagination can help you survive traumatic experiences.
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, I think a lot of artists will tell you that they see their studio as a sanctuary, you know, and it's like... And I used to sort of think of my creativity like an internal shed, you know, and when I felt kind of vulnerable... I could kind of go up the imaginary steps into the internal shed and shut the door and just have thoughts about art or whatever it was. When I was young, it would have been Alan Measles' world, and that's a kind of comforting thing to do. You know, you because it's all inside. You're not disturbed by the outside world. Mm.
So, do you think being an artist and making art has actually ended up making you a happier person?
Total therapy.
I remember a lot of the early interviews. You seemed not necessarily angry, but you had some kind of like whether it was politically motivated or against the art world's elitism, all these things, you definitely were like, somehow.
I think I'm still like that, aren't
I? Yeah, but that's
I?
What I was going to say. No, but I also feel like maybe, I think maybe having a child yourself, having your marriage with your wife, like all of those influences, but primarily probably making art. Do you think that's helped make you a happier person?
Oh, yeah. But I think the main thing that's made me happy is therapy. You know, I wouldn't lay it all at art story. You know, I had a great experience in therapy. My wife is a psychotherapist, you know, and
she wasn't your therapist.
No, right. No, that would be unethical.
Yes.
But she obviously recommended that I had a go at it. And it did me a world of good. Intellectually and emotionally, it was the best thing. And still, you know, it still informs my view of the world now. You
know? Sometimes people say when they're creative, they don't want to do therapy, especially musicians I know. They'll be like, I can't go to therapy because I won't be able to write songs anymore.
You might fuck up your instinct.
No, exactly, because they feel
that's
like...
That's what they say to actors about drama school, is that if you're an instinctive actor and you go to drama school and they start going like, why are you doing that? And it makes you question your own instincts. It can fuck you up and make you technical.
Didn't find that with your therapy?
No, I thought of it as like someone coming into your tool shed and tidying it up. You know, you've still got the tools and all the rubbish is gone. You know, and I think that a lot of people think that they are their quirks, and I think that's an illusion. Mm. You know, we have our emotional framework and our skills, and we can bring them to bear, and surely, you know, you want to optimize that. Mm. A lot of people, you know, struggle if they've got, I mean, if a person is just doing okay and is not having any kind of mental health issue, then don't worry about it, just get on with it. But if you're having problems, don't think that they're supporting your creativity. They might well be getting in the way of it.
Mm.
And your wife wrote a book about childhood and growing, being parenting,
yes,
and bringing up children, and it's an acclaimed book now.
Yes.
And your relationship with her, I think I've read once or twice you say something like your best ideas came from your wife, maybe. Is that relationship like a really important...
Of course. Yeah, because, you know, we discuss, you know, have long conversations about relationships and emotional sort of and society and, you know, those sort of things. And, you know, that's the lens we share looking at the world. So we have those discussions and I check out, you know, she's pretty, very good at kind of whether I'm being bonkers or not.
Right.
You know, like whether I'm, because my tendency is to see the world and think everybody thinks like me. And she'll say, no, that's just you, Grace. The world isn't like you.
So it's important to have that sounding board.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Does she critique your work as well?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, I like her to like it.
Mm.
That would be, you know, if I did something she didn't like it, it was like, I'd probably be a bit upset.
Question it, would you? Right?
Yeah, I would.
So as a fellow Essex boy, how much has Essex played into your work? I know you built the house for Essex a few years back, which is amazing, in Radnes.
That's right.
On the river. But how much has the actual growing up in Essex played into your work?
Particularly early on, it's very important, I think, for my sort of sense of identity. And it was before identity sort of really has the vibe it has now.
Mm-hmm.
Because if I said I came from Essex, people would go, where is Essex? You know, it didn't have this strong identity, not in the 80s. And it wasn't till the late 80s, I think, people, the Essex jokes started to come along and the white stilettos and all those sort of cliches, which were kind of had an element of truth in them because of the sort of Cockney diaspora, I suppose, that makes up the southern half of Essex. I always describe it to Americans as the New Jersey of Britain.
Yeah, that's what I say.
Yeah.
That's what I say. From Manhattan, it is Jersey.
Yeah.
Essex is to London.
Yeah. And then, but the northern part, which, you know, and I lived in various parts of Essex. The northern part is actually very rural and old. Yeah,
some bits of it are beautiful, historical. The village I'm from, where I moved to when I was about 14, Billericay, is twinned with Billericay, Massachusetts. And it's where the Mayflower, people from the Mayflower went over. It's like, and some people said to me, isn't Essex just one big shopping centre?
No, it's not at all. I mean, you know, it's a sort of schizophrenic county, I would describe it, you know, because it's a home county, so it is very influenced by London. But at the same time, it has this sort of, I think slightly undiscovered northern half that's very sort of rural because it's overshadowed by the identity of the only way is Essex and things like that. But it's, you know, good people come out of Essex. Billy Bragg, Russell Brand, Russell Tovey.
Yes.
You know, fantastic people.
But I like you describing it as a Cockney diaspora.
Yeah.
That is beautiful and I've never heard that before and that makes total sense because so many gangsters moved there and bought these big houses.
They do. Totally that. They pave over the drive. They've got two Range Rover Sports.
Correct.
And a Fiat 500 for the wife.
Exactly. So we ask every guest that comes on two questions.
Right.
First question is, if you could do an art heist and you have a touchstone artwork anywhere in the world, anything in the world,
right,
and you can steal it and live with it forever, what would that be and why?
Ooh, golly. Okay. It probably changes over the time. I mean, it used to be Bruegel.
Yeah.
But my one of this week, I've seen a lot of museums lately, and I was in Rome over the weekend, I was looking in the Capitoline Museum, and there's the famous sculpture of Romulus and Remus and the wolf
drinking from the
teats,
the nipples
of
yeah.
the thing. And it's beautiful because the wolf sculpture, which is bronze itself, is ancient. It's like, I think it's ancient Greece or Thracian or something. They're yeah. not quite sure. But the Romulus and Remus, they're Renaissance. So they're like quite cherubby.
Yeah.
And I love it. And it's on a fantastic plinth. And the room it's in is great. So I wouldn't mind. That's my present favourite artwork. I really like that. It.
And where was it in Rome?
It's in the Capitoline Museum, which okay. is on the Capitol Hill.
Wasn't it based on the thylacine cat, which is now extinct?
Is it?
I think that was what the...
Is that what it is?
Yeah.
But anyway, it's a great sculpture. It's got that kind of... It's sort of elegant and primitive, which is that great energy.
Like folk art. Who are your ceramicists you look at, like historical ones or working now, that you're like, they're doing a good job?
I mean, I like sort of the whole culture of ceramics. So I tend to like sort of, you know, Islamic ceramics. It feeds into my work. I like the kind of sort of the ceramic purity of it. It's still, even the most sort of highly crafted Islamic ceramics, you still see that they're ceramic and the glaze is still a little bit runny and the cobalt is still a little bit bleedy and things like that. And a lot of, you know, Chinese, Japanese, these are the kind of classic ceramic cultures. I quite like some pottery from some of the African countries.
Yeah.
You know, the traditional kind of societies. So I'll pick and choose, you know. And I like early British, you know, folk, when you had like slipwear, early British slipwear.
Yeah, like Lucy Rye or...
No. I'm talking early as in, you know, 15th, 16th
century.
Right. You know...
Tankards for...
Yeah, Thomas Toft, you know, big plates and... lovely old harvest jugs that have been carved and stuff like that. Folk art is a big influence on me.
Totally.
And outsider art, of course. Yeah. So all those things. I don't tend to be influenced by contemporary art. Though, of course, if you're in the business, you have to keep an eye on it. Make sure what the opposition
is. Do you collect?
No, not really. I mean, I collect dresses. Dresses and motorbikes seem to be the things I kind of accumulate.
Well, that's interesting. I really wanted to talk to you about motorbikes because one of the things I've always loved in your work is this idea of freedom and the idea of transport. So whether it be planes from like World War II or something, but this idea of planes, I know that was an early a motif for you. But the main one for me is motorbikes because motorbikes are a bigger passion as art is for you in your life, no?
Well, I've probably spent more money on them than anything, you know, because I've got this very expensive habit of having custom motorcycles built. Which are eye-bleedingly expensive. It's something I love. And I think that you're right. I mean, I think what it is as a metaphor, when I was going through therapy, most of my dreams would either feature a car, a skateboard, a mountain bike, or a motorbike, because they were all about the drive of life. I think I'm a very driven, and I like to be in control. It was all about control and stuff like this. So... that as a motif, it's cropped up again and again in my unconscious. And still, you know, in my recent show, you know, there's a great big huge print of a car.
Yes.
So I do, that's something that I will come back to a time and time again. I think it's that sort of drive of life. It's the journey of life. It's the narrative and the romance. And there's a sort of you're sort of in life traveling through it, but you're also isolated from it. So I'm a very self-reliant, driven person. So that's me.
And I heard you talk about the idea of being at a red light. And if you're on a light, if you're on a bike and you've got the red light, and then as it turns green, that feeling of like being able to go off it faster than any car or...
Yeah, if you sit on a bike that's got, you know, anything from 100 horsepower up and you, drop the clutch at the lights, you know all about acceleration, you know.
Which
I think people who drive, even, you know, sports cars can be phenomenal, but a motorbike, you're there and... I just like the whole mechanicalness of it.
Mm. And coming to today's interview, you cycled here, and I offered to send a car when I was speaking to Victoria Miro to organise the interview, and they were like, oh, no, 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 Grayson will come on his bike. And I said to my friend Ben, he writes in The Independent, and he was like, I love Grayson Perry because he cycles and he really believes in cycling.
Yeah.
And I didn't even know that about you. And Ben's got this whole thing about trying to make London more friendly for cyclists, because obviously, A, environmentally,
I think it's happening,
and it's happening
though,
slowly, but it's been a big thing politically.
I think it's in some ways, I think that the environmental message is great, but I don't think that's why people cycle.
Okay.
I think most people cycle because it's quicker.
Yes.
Right.
You know, that's certainly why I cycle.
Bikes, yeah.
You know, it's you know, even Top Gear did a test where they raced across London and the bicycle trounced the rest of the way. Yeah. You know. And so, yeah, if you want to bike, you know, I halve my journey times, basically. And so I've always cycled in London, and now it's becoming more popular, which makes it, you know, it makes, has good things about it. But, you know, cycling in rush hour can be challenging sometimes, you know, because you put a macho arsehole on a bike, he's the same macho arsehole who's in the car.
Right.
Do you wear a crash helmet?
Most of the time, yeah, I do. If I've had a hairdo, though, I don't.
Did you wear one today?
I wore one today because I did, you know, I'm not dressed up today. But if I'm going out, because quite often I ride as Claire to a do.
So you have a customised crash helmet for the
day? No, I might put a headscarf on to save my hair in the wind. But you know.
But you have made customised bikes, no?
Oh, yeah.
Like you made one for Alan Measles as well, didn't you?
Yeah, I had a motorbike for Alan Measles with a shrine on for him. And then I've had I did a bike as a push bike as a artwork for my show at the Serpentine, which had a big silver statue on the front of it.
What was the bike you were riding on the cover of your book?
What book is that?
The autobiography.
Oh, that's just the one we borrowed for the photo shoot. Okay, it was like an oversized adult tricycle.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, because I wanted to look like a little kid.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Love that.
So the other question we ask every guest who comes on Talk Art is, what is your favourite colour?
That is a question I absolutely hate.
Yes!
Why do you hate it, Grayson?
Because it, you know, it's that. I hate the word "what's your favourite." Really, I don't, because I change all the time. And as someone who's passionate about colour, I would say that my favourite colour is the one that goes with the colour I've just chosen. So it's all about, you know, relationships, and you know, colour is like, for visual artists, is like perfect pitches for a musician. So it's, you know, there's certain artists who have, like, say someone like Matisse, who had sort of perfect colour pitch. And some artists don't quite have it. You know, they might be brilliant on the concept, their drawing might be phenomenal in their ambition or whatever, but their colour is a little bit off. And also, different cultures have different kind of attitudes to colour as well. So I always enjoy, for me, colour is quite politicised, you know, in that men, for instance, shrink from it. So I have a rule, I never buy black clothes. But men on the whole dress to be invisible. You know, because they want to. I call it the portable bird hide, which they want to wear. You know, so they can look out at the world and you know. And I think that men are less comfortable about being the one who's looked at, which is a big part of the joy of being a transvestite, is that you are the one that's looked at. And I think a lot of men would like some of that action. They just don't quite feel comfortable about how they might have to do what they might have to do to get that attention.
Logistics to get there.
Yeah, the work.
Yeah. Well, that's good to know about the black. So we should tell your students at St. Martin's, never design you a black dress because you'll never buy it.
Well, I say that, but if you know it was good enough, I'd break my own rule. But yeah.
Maybe it needs to have a lot of volume. Like it could be about the silhouette.
Yeah, but black is I think is a lazy default. The fashion world is particularly prone to it. You know, you look at the fro on a lot of shows, and everyone's wearing black.
Mm-hmm. Amazing, you're amazing.
Thanks.
Thank you for coming on.
Fun.
I was actually
fun.
Thinking in your new show, that work about the tax havens on the car. The colours in that work are totally like intense. Yeah. I was actually trying to imagine having to live with that work, like the actual brightness of the green. And like, do you often put colours together in a way to sort of contrast or shock or something?
I do think about, you know, it's either going to be in a museum or in someone's house, and it's a big thing. It's 3 by 2 meters, so it's going to be the dominant artwork in the room. So it might as well really pop, you know. And I even have a coloured frame, you know, to sort of help the. That I want it to be a kind of pop object. I've done prints that are black and white, you know, and I enjoy those. But
which I've seen actually being made at Pauper's Press over the years when we were doing prints
ourselves. Pauper's Press are great.
Yeah. What's next for Grayson?
Next is, what's next? My next thing is I'm doing a couple of my stage shows in Australia.
Oh, yeah.
In January. And then I've got almost immediately a show opening in Bath called Grace and Perry, The Pre-Therapy Years, which is all my early work.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So it's all pre-92. Yeah.
Is Louisa Buck's work going to be?
I think Louisa Buck will have some pieces in it. Amazing. And it's, yeah, it's going to be fun seeing. I haven't seen those for like 30 odd years.
Wow. So is that going to be, do you think that's going to be tough for you?
No, it'll be fun. You know, I'm kinder to my old work now. You know, I used to smash it if I had a mood with it, but now I'm kind of more forgiving of it, and it's sort of funny. And I'm still there in a raw form, you know, yeah. All of the anger, all of the naughtiness, teasing, it's all there.
Yeah.
And it's quite an interesting location, Bath. If you think of your current show in Mayfair and then that show in Bath, I've always loved Bath because of the history, you know, a bit like somewhere like Rome. It's got that sense of timelessness. And
yeah.
It was because the museum there came up with the idea and asked me, but also it's going to tour. I think it's going to like round the country. I think it's going to like Norwich, Chatsworth and York, I think.
Brilliant.
So out of every artist we've met, I think you're somebody that has a very strong sense of self and also incredible self-confidence and drive. Because we have a lot of younger artists listening to this. Yes. What advice would you give like a younger artist now?
Ooh, yeah, it's tricky. I think it's harder than ever to be an artist now because there's so many more students and things, and it's, you know, more expensive and it's difficult. I would say think about the art world and then think about what you want out of it. You know, do you want to be, you know, where are your passions? Because you've also got to think about, you want to make a living. So I always thought when I left college, there were sort of two main arteries you could go on. One was the kind of, I used to call them, the Acme artists, after the kind of artist studio organization. And they were kind of, they would do art that was like political, activist, public facing, probably publicly funded quite often as well, and worthy. Mm-hmm. And then there would be the other side that I called them the trendies, who would make art that was quite fashionable and sensuous and covetable and sort of aimed at the collector more. And, you know, you can make those. I mean, there's a whole spectrum in between those two things. And I like to think, you know, I'm somewhere in between those things. But, you know, I always did go for the collector end of it. And I've always made things that people wanted to buy. My very first show sold out, even though the top price was 80 quid.
I was going to say, because you sold work very quickly, didn't you? For like 30 quid, 80
quid. I've always sold. You've always really sold well. Yeah. And my advice to young people is, don't overprice your work. A, you'll get more studio space because you better clear it out. And B, it's like they're your ambassadors out there. You know, they're on people's walls. And particularly sell to give real discount to journalists early on as well.
Because, good tip.
We interviewed Louisa Buck. We interviewed Louisa Buck for this, and she spoke about the pot from when she was pregnant and about to have her first child or something, and you gave her a pot of her giving birth.
If an art journalist wants your work, you know, be really flattered because they've probably got great taste because they look at a grot of art.
True.
And then B, give them a discount because they'll be your ambassadors. You know, and it's great. And I think
that's excellent.
Good advice.
The other thing I would say is, don't overuse this tip, but put the names of famous collectors on your pots occasionally.
I heard that one. Apparently they then buy it. So if you put their name on the pot,
I never use it.
Their vanity and ego will be like, he's mentioned me on my pot, I'm going to buy that pot.
Yeah. I need that pot.
Yeah, I need that pot. Yeah. You need to put Russell's name on
one. It's almost like a self-portrait, like a portrait you've done of someone, isn't it?
Yeah. So I've only used that about once a decade, but it bang worked every time.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Love that. Well, thank you so much for coming on. This has been an absolute joy. And
for all images of the artworks we've spoken about today, you can see it at our Instagram, at TalkArt.
Yeah.
Are you on Instagram?
Yes, I am.
What's your handle?
Alan Measles.
Is it? Okay. Mm. I'm not sure I've seen your Instagram, weirdly.
No, I've only been on it about a month.
How are you finding it?
It's different from Twitter, because I love Twitter and I've been on that for years and years. Instagram is kind of sort of benign.
It's less trolling, I guess.
Yeah, you're very aware very quickly. Somebody put it very well the other day. They said, it immediately makes you think about the muscularity of your images. And that was bang on, because you know, you look at an image and if it pops off the screen, then it works. And I've started to think much more visually about what I put up, whereas Twitter is just like snark, snark, snark.
Yeah.
I find it incredibly, like, you can learn so much, because you can sort of really get into images of, yeah. of if you don't know something, you can kind of start to learn about
scour
it.
Scour someone's yeah. grid, as they call it.
Oh my God, I hate that.
Someone yeah. goes like, I love your grid, bro.
Yeah, I tend to go to Pinterest quite a lot. When
I hate Pinterest.
Why do you hate Pinterest?
Because you click on it and then it goes to some other kind of estuary somewhere else. I don't know, I find it...
Exactly how I work, so because you click on an image and then there'll be all related image underneath it.
Right.
So you refine it very quick. You get to, you know, if you're looking for a certain thing, you're like, I'm looking for a vase, but then you think, oh, I want a blue vase. And then it's like a blue vase with flowers on, and then a blue vase with flowers that are actually squares. And then, you know, you can refine it down.
I've never used Pinterest. I always thought Pinterest was like interior designers, which I guess was good for your research.
It's lots of art, fashion. But, fashion is very good. I use it a lot when I'm looking for inspiration for outfits.
Okay, interesting.
A lot of fashion on it, yeah.
I haven't done it. There is trolling on Instagram because I've had lots of trolling in the last few weeks.
Trolling.
I'm going to get a lot of hate now. But no, I've had lots of like emoji shits sent to me.
Emoji? Why not emoji? Anything right?
I don't know.
I mean, another thing I'd say to young people, you know, get anxious about social media, just don't read below the line. You know,
yeah. Yeah. Take the comments off.
Yeah.
It's a lot easier.
No, I had someone write to me saying that I was dead inside and that when I smile, it's so fake. Had another one saying, am I sleeping with you? And that like all this kind of weird shit and that they hate me because I am. I'm not sleeping with him. Thanks very much. But anyway, so there is definitely trolling.
Yes. Trolling? With emojis. Yeah.
Trolls.
Yes.
Yeah. Good times. Well, thank you so much, Grace
thank
and Perry.
Thank you very much.
Been fun.
We'll be back very soon,
very
everyone.
Soon.
Thanks
Bye.
For listening. Bye. You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diamant and Russell Tovey. Follow us on Instagram at Talk Art, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in this episode. Subscribe to Talk Art at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. Make a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. You can even save time by going from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds. Join the 96% of Grammarly users that say it helps them craft more impactful writing. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.